My name's Rick Davis, and I've started politics in the early 1970s, long before everybody in this room was born. And I was a conservative Republican, and I practiced politics for 30 years and ran many campaigns both on a local level and on a national level, and ran into issues related to the environment on a regular basis. And over that period of time, the luxury of being old like me is that you see everything change. And so change has happened with environmental issues. And today, I would say, is a much better environment for those issues in a political campaign than they've ever been in my lifetime. After getting out of politics, I went into private equity, and I actually do in private equity what I believe in, and that is sustainable development. So I invest in things like renewable energy and recycling and things that I believe are better for the world and are the future of the world. In other words, I believe we are migrating economically toward a more sustainable world like we are politically in using those issues for political campaigns.
And I'm Linda Tran. As I said, I'm on the Democratic side of the aisle here. I'm one of the founding partners of 270 Strategies, which was a company that was created by a number of Obama alum who came off the campaign trail or were part of the administration. Me personally, I was the National Press Secretary for Organizing for America, which was the campaign in waiting in between both Obama presidential campaigns. And I was also communications director for Tim Kaine when he was governor of Virginia, where he was, as an outdoorsman, made the environment and preservation of open land a major priority of his time while he was in office. So I've gotten to see it mostly from the policy side of things, somewhat from the campaign side of things, and then recently, over the years that we've been building our new company, I've worked with state-level candidates, I've worked with congressional candidates who are now being faced with issues from flooding to hurricanes to just figuring out what to do when the water quality is not good where you're at. So the things that we're going to talk about today are very, very real. We see them play out in practice all the time, and so let's get to it.
Great. Module one that you'd seen before getting into our module really explored the different opinions and attitudes that voters have toward climate and the environment. The data is pretty compelling. I remember when I first got started in John McCain's presidential campaign in 2000, nobody was talking about climate as an issue. And that period of time between 2000 and 2008, all of a sudden when we went into the field and started preparing for a presidential campaign for McCain in 2008, everybody was curious as to what was happening on environmental issues. Even in South Carolina, a primary state for Republicans that veers toward conservative voters, I would say that the vast majority were concerned about their environment, they were concerned about their local environment, how it affected them every day, and we incorporated that into our campaign in a way that helped us win South Carolina that year. So the idea that it only works in certain places, I think is pretty rebuked. The data that Module 1 tells us is that this is an issue that you can run on. The examples they use in Module 1 shows that campaigns can actually employ environmental messages in their campaigns in a winning fashion. And so while we know now that the data is compelling and that we should be using it, let's talk a little bit about how to make decisions on what those messages should be.
And so today, for this module, we're going to be expanding on the various things that were talked about in Module 1. In particular, how is it that you really employ an environmental message as part of your campaign? How do you localize it so that it actually makes a difference when you're talking to voters who may not actually care about, you know, what happens with the Paris Climate Treaty, but they care about what happens in their everyday community. They care about what happens on a local level. So we're going to get into some of that today. So first off, it's worth talking about why we do messaging at all. So messaging at the end of the day is really just storytelling. And if you think about it, storytelling is nothing new. It's something that has existed from the very, very early days. You know, there's a reason why cavemen drew pictures on walls. There's a reason why over the millennia and even today we sit around campfires and share stories. And that is fundamentally because it helps us kind of understand who we are as a community. It helps us express shared values. It helps us feel a sense of group and camaraderie that allows us to make things happen in human world. So, stories end up motivating us, they teach us, and they help compel us towards meaningful action. And if you're building a campaign, the thing that you care about most is organizing, and organizing is about shared responsibility. It's about communicating a message to the audience you want to move, and it's about getting them to actually move. And so that's why we do this. The other thing to think about is, as you're building a campaign, you are setting up a narrative that allows people who you want to stand with you to do so proudly. And you're setting up a campaign and narrative that makes really clear to the opposition where you're at. So it's a, exercise, as David Plouffe would say, is always an exercise in comparisons. And so you want to set up the pros and you want to set up the cons. The other thing to think about is, when you are sitting down and plotting out what your message is, the very first thing to think about is your audience. Who are these people? What do they care about? You're going to find as we go through the module today that we're going to talk a lot about the economy, which may be surprising to people who haven't really thought about the environment, haven't really thought about how you incorporate that into the kind of kitchen table issues that voters typically care about when they are, figuring out who it is they're going to pull that lever for, who it is they're going to punch that card for, because in some places they still do. The other thing to think about is the moment that you're in. So there's always going to be something happening, sadly. Whether it is some sort of a catastrophe that hits, Texas or Florida that really changes the dynamics and changes the metrics, or it is somebody passing a program or a piece of policy that really allows you to drive home whatever it is that you were trying to get across in your message, you need to be aware of that so that you can actually take advantage of the moment. And then the final thing is just being consistent. So you want to take advantage of the moment and be flexible and be able to respond in a rapid fashion, but you also want to be able to beat that drum, meaning if you have something to say, say it over and over and over again. You can't expect that anybody over the course of a campaign at any level, national, state, or local, has heard what you said the first time. You're going to have to say it many, many more times. So, process for developing a message. There are a lot of different ways you can do it, and as Rick, I'm sure, could attest, it really matters what your budget is. That's going to define how much you can actually do. But typically, in an ideal world, what you want to be able to do is do some research. And as you saw in Module 1, research and polling can really give you a sense of what messages actually work really well, what are persuasive, what are not, where people are, in particular the audience that you're looking at, where they happen to be at a moment, and when after they hear a particular message, how it moves them. It's really important to know if you have the budget to do so. You also want to make sure that you are very, very clear about who your targets are. So who is it that you're talking to? A mom in a suburb is going to have different cares and concerns and react differently than somebody who's in the urban core. Somebody who is 55 or 60 years old is probably going to respond differently to issues than somebody who is in the infamous millennial bracket. So really thinking about, who it is that you're talking to and what they care about before you sit down to craft your message. And then the final thing is, if you have the room to do it, if you have the capacity, if you have the mental willpower, ideally what you're doing is you're testing things out on the front end and checking to see if it works. Are you actually moving people? If you're not, then you should be adjusting and refining your message. That doesn't mean that you change the overall narrative for your campaign, but it might mean that you hit on one thing over another. So maybe you're focused on water quality and that's not really moving people because it's not resonating in that community, but you might switch to talking about a clean energy economy and the kind of jobs that you're creating. So just thinking about what works and what doesn't.
One of the reasons we do all this data and discussions about how to create messages is because ultimately we have to actually deliver those messages to voters. One of the ways we do that is through various communications, advertising, direct communication, what the candidate says in his speeches and everyday press conferences and directly to voters, direct mail material and all kinds of other communication devices through social media. So we develop those messages in a way to be able to deliver them. And then the question then is, what do you put in that delivery mechanism? What do you put in your ad? What do you put in to the social media in order to motivate voters to, one, pay attention because they're inundated every day with all kinds of information, and how do you differentiate that? And then two, how to make an impact? How do you get them to remember what you just told them? Linda mentioned earlier in our module about repetition. That's key, but also some kind of impact matters, whether it's in your direct mail piece, in social media, or on TV. So one of the things we wanted to do is show you a little bit about how to deliver a message with punch. One of the things we'll discuss in this module is how to use values in a communication messaging campaign. And so I think one of my favorite ads was done by the Environmental Defense Fund a number of years ago as a PSA that was able to try to change the public's attitude toward climate issues, make it real for them, make it current, make it actually something they care today about, not just some point in the future. And this ad, I think, demonstrates that in an incredibly impactful way.
Global warming. Some say irreversible consequences are 30 years away. 30 years? That won't affect me.
Now this brings 30 years away right to your doorstep. This brings it right into your heart. You can't look at that ad and not be impacted that, oh my God, I'm leaving the world and my country and my neighborhood to my children in a way that is much worse than when I got it. And so I think these are the kinds of things that you have to explore within your campaign, how to make the message big enough to incorporate a lot of different voters, but impactful enough for them to remember that this is something you believe strongly about. I think this ad does exactly that.
And Rick has this whole theory about progression to impact that I'm sure he'd be excited to share.
Yeah, so we talk to people in a lot of different ways. And one of the ways we talk about it is in the messages that we give to people. And I have this theory that we want to live in a certain place within a campaign. So if you're a campaign manager and you're saying, what am I talking about every day? I've created this inverted pyramid to help you as a guide. And what this represents is that you have three different ways of talking to voters. Values, talking about issues, and attitudes. Voters have attitudes that change hourly. You pick up the newspaper in the morning and you're mad. You see a TV show and you're happy. And so that's something that's very ephemeral. And if you live in the attitude business in a campaign, not only will you be exhausted by the end of the campaign, but you'll likely lose because people will keep trading off these attitudes throughout your campaign. Issues is a better place to be. They are what drive a lot of campaigns. You know, I can't help tell you how many times I've been in a room where, you know, this candidate says, tell me what the issues in this campaign are gonna be. And you have a laundry list, right? And in fact, when you take polling data, you usually ask people, rank 1 to 10 these issues, and you usually have about 10 or 11 issues, and they rank them, and then you think, oh great, this is the holy grail to, you know, talking to voters. Problem is, voters all have a different priority order of those issues. So one day, national security might be important because there's been an incident in a faraway capital or something at home that reminds you that terrorism is a next door issue, and all of a sudden national security becomes issue number one. Typically we see economics as issue number one until something happens, you know, in London or Paris or New York. So those things change and people's priorities change all the time on issues. So you have to deal with them as a campaign, but you're dealing with them in a constantly changing environment. Something that never changes is your values. People's values are constant. They don't trade them off. They don't make them happy or sad, and they certainly don't prioritize them. Your set of values are what makes you as a person, as a voter, and you don't want to see those in any kind of rank order. You never say, life is more important to me than health. You think both of those things are important. In fact, you think your values are linked. That's what makes you a person. That's what you want to talk about when you're in a campaign. Ronald Reagan used to do this extraordinarily well. He always talked about values. Crime to him was about safe neighborhoods and comfort and ability to raise your family, you know, safely. It wasn't about the number of cops you had on the street or the amount of time you put in a jail term for somebody who's committing a crime. Those are issues, not values. And so what we want you to do as a campaign is to be able to talk about environmental issues as values to voters. And I think we've got some really good examples and how to get there in a process of evaluating what works for you in your local communities, states, or nationally.
So how do you actually operationalize all of this if you are that first-time candidate or you are running a campaign for the first time, regardless of what level you're at? The one truism that I think everybody believes is true, regardless of what side of the aisle you're on, is that all politics is local. And your impact and your ability to actually drive a message home is going to depend on your ability to localize it to what's happening within your community. So, you know, your effective messages are the ones that actually, again, as we talked about before, think about who it is you're talking to. Think about who it is you need to move. Your campaigns are won on the margin. So if it is a particular demographic group, or it is a particular set of communities or precincts that you need to move, what is it that they're worried about? And how do you turn those environmental issues into something that feels relevant to their local area? So one example, and probably the one that we're going to beat the drum on the most, is tying environmental issues and green issues to the economy. How does it actually affect people's bottom lines? You know, one good example of this was during the Obama administration, one of his big priorities was passing a corporate average fuel economy standard, meaning reducing the amount of money that people have to pay at the pump. So you talk about CAFE standards, that sounds totally wonky, and who cares, right? You could, in one way, have stamped CAFE onto a banner and made that part of his presentation. But when Barack Obama talked about fuel economy standards, he didn't necessarily focus on the environment. That was certainly part of the shtick. You know, he talked about, you know, reducing carbon emissions and ensuring that the air quality and all these other sorts of things were preserved for generations to come. But the core of his message was always about consumers and their pocketbooks, how much they were going to end up paying at the pump, and also what kinds of advances were going to happen so that we were creating a whole new sector of jobs that would ultimately benefit every single community. So again, big environmental issue. What we're essentially talking about is pollution from cars, but the way that he made it relevant to people was by making it about their pocketbooks.
This is a great example of how to take a message that is an issue, healthcare, and drive it up into a value chain that you can use in your campaign. So not many people think in terms of healthcare as being an environmental issue. And so when we break it down, we can see a lot of impacts, you know, with voters related to healthcare. Obviously, access to healthcare has been a major debate for a long time, but living in a healthy environment is a driver to being able to discuss healthcare. So when we look at some of this module, we're going to be talking about things like water quality, air quality, food, and other kinds of healthy lifestyles. And this is a way to get out of the normal debate in healthcare, which has really stagnated quite a bit. I remember when I was coming up through politics, I was always told never talk about healthcare as a Republican because that's playing on the Democratic battlefield. The problem is that battlefield is so flat now, everyone's on it, whether you like it or not. You don't have a choice as to whether you're going to do it. But what we want to give voters and give candidates an opportunity to do is expand the debate on healthcare rather than just worrying about an access issue. Worry about how to avoid negative consequences to your environment. And there are really practical ways to do that if you can expand this issue group into more of an environmental impact.
One of the ways you might think about it is talking about asthma that kids may have in a particular community because the air is so polluted that it is literally impacting individual families on that level. But the point here that Rick is making is making it real, making it local, making it really something that people can relate to. Another way of thinking about the environment is really just basically about the quality of life. So you may talk about having open parks and open land so that, you know, your families and the people that you care about, your neighbors, all these other folks can actually enjoy it. But one thing that I would point out that is important is if you're going to talk about quality of life and you're going to talk about the environment in this way, you want to make it relatable and you want to make it come down to earth. So it's not just a 30,000 foot aspiration that you have for the future, it's something about right now. One example was when Tim Kaine was governor of Virginia, it was well known that he was an outdoorsman. You know, when he had time off, which is rare when you're a governor, the thing he always wanted to do was go hiking. You know, we used to joke about the fact that, you know, there was a governor who claimed that he was hiking in the Appalachian Trail while Governor Kaine was in his administration. And when people came to ask me about it, I said, yes, you know, when my governor's hiking, he's actually hiking. So it was very, very well known that he was somebody who cared about the outdoors. You know, he had all these images of him with his family from the time they were very little kids, you know, walking past waterfalls, kids on his back, things like that. And so it wasn't really surprising to people that as he laid out what his platform was for his administration, which is short in Virginia. It's a four-year term, and that's all you get. So you have to make everything count. You know, he talked about things like education and creating jobs, but he also made a key pillar of his platform the preservation of 400,000 acres of open land. And what was this about? It was about ensuring that Virginia remained a place where you could also enjoy the world that you were in. It was a place where your kids could breathe clean air, and that was something that you actually have to take policy action in order to preserve for the long run. And so that is how he made it real. And the point about him being an outdoorsman is that people really understood why he was doing it. It was authentic to who he was, and it made sense as part of his priorities in his administration.
One of the things on this I would add, too, is when the pollsters sit down and they say, okay, we've got to, you know, find out what voters are thinking right now before we start a campaign, they always ask the voters, what are your hopes, dreams, and aspirations? And 9 times out of 10, they're going to say, a better world for my children. Like the train ad that we just saw, where it brought it right back to home. In other words, oh well, you know, maybe climate change is 30 years away. Why do I have to worry about it? You have to worry about it because in that 30 years, your children will be you. And you want them to have an environment and a lifestyle and a health that's at least equal to yours. And I think everybody would agree that they want it to be better off for their children. Today, there's a challenge in doing that, and campaigns need to meet that challenge by talking about what those hopes, dreams, and aspirations are for the parents who are going to be voting for the children like you see in this screen.
So when you're sitting down to talk messaging and create your message, how do you actually do it? There are a whole bunch of different ways that people will sit down and write out what the narrative is, think about what their talking points are for a given speech, or what their press releases, what, you know, their campaign banners say. And we're going to talk about two different ways of doing it today. The first is a message triangle. And to be clear, there are lots of different ways to do a message triangle as well. The way that we're going to do it is essentially identifying the problem, then talking about what opportunity or opportunities, plural, exist, and then pulling that back to the solution that you as a candidate or you as a campaign are trying to present to the world. So simplifying very, very complicated issues into this kind of pattern will help make sure that you're really clear about the things that you're conveying. We're going to go through a couple of different kind of common issues that exist in the major regions of this country. And no surprise to anybody, the very first one we're going to start with is flooding and hurricanes and the kind of massive storms that we're seeing happen now in 2017 that are really impacting communities on a massive, massive scale. So, you know, if you think about back in 2005 when Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita occurred, you know, we hadn't seen anything like that as far as folks in this generation could really remember. You ended up with 1,800 people who lost their lives. I think the combination between the two was close to $200 billion. I think Katrina alone was $134 billion in cost to the economy. You know, it's no small feat. And now we're looking at Hurricane Harvey in Florida, Hurricane Maria hitting all kinds of other areas. And the cost of these storms is going to go far, far past what happened in Rita or Katrina, regardless of the number of lives that are lost.
And I would say, too, the press narrative is different with weather, right? In 20 years ago, the debate wasn't, you know, around what kind of weather patterns we have. Now, you would be unusual if you didn't pick up a newspaper in the course of a couple of days and find somebody talking about severe weather patterns being as a result of changes in the climate on a global basis. So we have migrated into an environment where climate and weather are now directly connected. You don't want to chase every storm and say, wow, you know, we had lightning today because of the climate. But there's no question that we've had severe weather patterns all across the country in virtually every segment of the country. And so as a political issue, it's just a reality of life. You're going to be talking about something in your district, your state, or nationally in the course of a campaign. And so how do you do that? How do you get from identifying the problem, you know, a severe weather event, in this case flooding, to what do you talk about it as a candidate? And I think that's where you try to identify the opportunity. What's the opportunity to discuss here? I think a good example that's on this board is failing infrastructure. It's kind of a boring issue, right? If your candidate stands up and says, what I really want to do is build new bridges, you know, you can hear the yawning in the background as voters tune out. But if those bridges have been washed out or endangered or are dangerous because of these severe weather patterns, people will stand up to think about that. So I think identifying a issue within the problem set that is directly affecting a voter is a good way to go. And of course, one of the things that are always driving political campaigns is the economy and jobs. And so what we try to do is migrate from those opportunities to practical solutions. What is the solution to the problem of failing bridges and roads and infrastructure due to severe weather patterns? Jobs and the economy.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, if you think about the solution, there are a whole bunch of different things that you can point to when it comes to the damage that comes from storms. It's obviously the wreckage to buildings and rebuilding. It is rebuilding the bridges and making sure that things are set up in a way that they are less likely to be so severely impacted in the future. It's the poor water quality that results after all kinds of things get dumped into our waterways as a result of these storms. So there are lots of different parts of the economic ecosystem, we'll blend those two things together, that you could be pointing to. And when you get to talking about solutions, I mean, one of the things that we know from polling is that the American electorate is really tired of the partisanship. You know, it's one of the reasons why Congress repeatedly gets into the single digits when, you know, people ask about whether they approve of the job that they're doing. They want to see people come together, and it kind of speaks to the values point that Rick made a little bit earlier. So you can start by saying, you know, one of the solutions here is to get people together, bring together stakeholders, and that's going to span a bunch of different kinds of groups, and make sure that we have policies in place that ensure that we're doing the rebuilding, we're doing the job creation, we're doing the kind of prevention management and thinking about climate change potentially as part of that, whether you're building a new structure that's going to have, you know, more kind of efficiency and not have such a great impact on our environment. All of those things you can weave together and make that part of the solution. So another issue that tends to strike the Midwest in particular is really around water quality. So no surprise for folks who are working in states that border the Great Lakes. Water quality in the Great Lakes themselves, again, tie very much to the economy. You know, there are fishing industries and all kinds of health issues and things like that that you can point out as part of your discussion about the water quality issues in the Midwest.
Yeah, and I think one of the things to remind everybody about now is the values-based discussion, right? What is the values that people have related to this? And that's the protection of their children. Right? As a parent, there is nothing more important than the health and well-being of your children. And so if there's a problem with your local water supply that's endangering your children, it's a confidence that you've lost in your government. You know, what is the government commitment to its residents, especially at a local level like this? And that is, you know, that we're going to give you a safe environment to raise your children, to earn a living, and to prosper as a family. And so when that trust is broken, it's broken on a values basis. So you have to talk about those as a candidate. The minute you develop down into sort of the solution set, you've got to make sure that also reflects a values basis. It can't just be that we're going to just change the pipes that run the water. I mean, people don't see that as a solution to something that's threatened the well-being of their family. You need to have that solution at the same values level as the issues that have been presented to you. So again, you know, finding a hook into what's the future? Okay, if we solve this, what's the impact on our communities, economics, and jobs? And so I think that as you sift through these issues, use them to dramatize the solution as much as you can. So here was the problem. We're in the process of solving that problem. We're creating a safe environment for our families to prosper. But like, what has been the impact on our economy? And how do we bring that back? And I think as a candidate, you have to have those solutions at a fingertip.
Yeah, and I think the trust in our institutions piece is really big here as well. When you think back to 2016 and Flint, Michigan, and the lead in the water and all the health issues that were heartbreaking stories that were brought into the national arena, ultimately at the end of the day, when you had candidates on both sides of the aisle talking about what needed to be done, what you were met with at the local level was massive skepticism. And why is that? It's because there had been such a massive failure on the part of those people who are supposed to be looking out for these very, very basic things that your family depends on, that it was very difficult for people to believe that there was going to be a solution that was actually meaningful and would actually impact their health.
And another great example of the inverted pyramid we talked about earlier, as an issue, you're going to trade off, you know, what your economic impact is for the safety and well-being of your family. So if someone says, well, it's going to cost millions of dollars to solve this problem, if the problem is affecting the health of your children, no one's going to care what the budget is. They're going to say, what are you doing to protect my kids? And so I think that's one of the things you have to evaluate as a candidate, and as a campaign is how do you address the issues that fall out from those values?
Yeah, and when it comes to water quality, I mean, it's pretty straightforward, right? Water quality is always a local issue. It's not something that's happening far away in Washington, D.C. It's happening right there in your local neighborhood. And so it's very clear to articulate that we need to make sure that we have clean drinking water. We need to make sure that our waterways are able to support the wildlife that we depend on for various industries. There's an opportunity, if there is a water quality issue, for there to be all kinds of downstream jobs that get created to help purify the water, to help make sure that everything from educating the community about what they may be doing that can help contribute to water quality or detract from it. It's all these other sorts of things combined, which then tie back to the economy. And again, the solution is, not surprisingly, you're going to hear me say this a lot, it is about making various stakeholders come together. It is about making sure that there are public awareness and education campaigns that are going on so that folks are not doing the terrible things that lead to poor water quality and ultimately impact our families. So the third issue here is on energy development. And what we're thinking about is, in particular, in the western region of this country, where there has been quite a boom over recent years, both in terms of kind of traditional fossil fuel development, but also companies that have thought of renewable energy sources and are starting to invest there. There's definitely a problem in the sense that, you know, as these various actors within the energy industry, whether they're on the traditional side or the renewable side, have done things like, you know, build the structures that they need in order to tap into these sources or get into mining and all these other sorts of things to get to energy, what's ended up happening is you've had things like oil spills, you've got fracking issues, you've got water quality problems, and all of these things impact, surprise, surprise, the economy. You know, tourism, if you're in an area that's getting polluted, people aren't going to want to go hiking or camping there. When things are disrupting things like migration patterns for birds, it also means that we're impacting all these other things that impact people on a local level. So one of the opportunities here that we have thought about is certainly we want to make sure that we're thinking about maintaining the energy prices for consumers at this particular moment as low as possible, but we also want to incentivize people to continue to innovate and continue to think about ways to create energy in a way that does not impact our environment.
Yeah, and I think we now have a situation in the United States where people take their energy for granted, right? I mean, there are a lot of countries around the world who are net short of energy, and they're used to brownouts and what they call load sharing, and so they understand the value. But we have electricity 24/7. Everything we have in our lives tends to run off of power, and we've gotten to the point where we expect it to be available to us at all times. But as Linda said, when you do have something happen in your community, whether a spill some kind of an air quality issue, it's brought back home to you that, oh my God, this is not without its risks. And it does affect your community. You don't want to be branded as the community that's dirty or polluted. And so I think people need to have an introduction to that. And I think using stakeholders like the utilities and others who all have an interest in being the friend of the consumer or the friend of the voter, bringing them to the table and making sure they're part of this discussion is a really effective way of bringing home your point. And I would lastly say, as far as what we talk a little bit about having carrots for people, one of the things that is important to understand too about energy as an issue is how much empowerment people have with their own energy today. Today, people can go to a store and buy an energy efficiency appliance. They can put LEDs into their households in order to lower their burn rate for lighting. And they can actually even take even more ownership of what kind of energy they use by putting solar panels on their roof. In that case, they're actually an energy provider. In some states, they're even allowed to sell power back to the grid. So when we talk about energy, it used to be one of these things where people just assumed that they would have it no matter what. Now they can actually do something about the energy they have. And I think that gives a voter an immense power behind this issue because they feel like they can own it a little bit more than just turn on a light and knowing that power will be there for them.
And the last primary issue that we wanted to talk about was air quality. And in particular, this is a relevant issue in the northeastern region of the country in the mid-Atlantic states, where you have clusters of cities and a lot of urban cores and manufacturing that have really contributed to our productivity and our economic success and growth, but have also really impacted the air that we breathe and the kind of air quality that we are making available to our families. And so problem, very, very clear. You know, you've got many rather smaller states as compared to other parts of the country that are clustered together. So the problems actually cross state lines very, very easily. One of the contributing factors that is often pointed to is the use of wood stoves, for example, in the further northeastern part of the country, which is obviously important to any ordinary average family who wants to keep their house warm, but is maybe not the cleanest source of heat energy. And so how do you actually impact these kinds of individuals and get them to change their behavior? One opportunity to think about is, again, these things are happening across states. So it's not that, you know, the governor of Rhode Island can decide that they're going to do a series of particular actions and that's going to solve the problem, because those bordering states around Rhode Island are going to have an impact. It's not that, you know, Pennsylvania can act alone. So there is an opportunity here for there to be more expansive policies. There's a way to kind of universalize, actually. We've talked a lot about localizing, but in the Northeast, there's a way of universalizing the problems and the solutions themselves. And there are, if you live in the Northeast, you are familiar with the idea of tax incentive days so that you can buy more fuel efficient appliances. You're familiar with the kinds of policies that various members of in government have come up with to get people to change the way that they act in a way that actually has a massive influence on the quality of the air across a number of different states.
And these cross-border issues are really important. I mean, air doesn't know that you live in a certain district or your state lines or anywhere. And so you need to broaden this debate up significantly. As Linda said, you know, you can really create a jurisdiction around it that is much larger than your own district, state, or region. And I think by doing that, you can also elevate the debate. Nobody wants pollution. Nobody wants bad air. Again, it's a quality of life issue. You know, what are you breathing? You know, is it going to attract more people to your district, either because of tourism or economic activity? You know, what is our reputation as a community, you know, if we have bad air? And so I think this is the kind of thing where you can create a zero tolerance for any misbehaving, either in your own community or around the region.
Great. So we've talked about all of this in theory, and now what we want to do is give you a number of different examples of how this actually played out on the campaign trail in real life. So first, we're going to start with a tool. So you've already heard about the message triangle. Now we're going to talk about the message box. This is, again, there are a lot of different ways that people do message development. There are a lot of different ways that people might craft what it is they're going to say to the world. But as a tool, the message box is very, very commonly used, because what it sets up in particular on a campaign is you thinking about what you're going to say about yourself, you thinking about what your attacks on your opponent are going to be, and then vice versa. What do you think they're going to say about you? And you're anticipating, based on research that you may have done, the vulnerabilities that you might have. And also, what are they going to say about themselves? What are their strengths? So this is a very commonly used tool to set up the dynamic of a message on a campaign. So the first example we're going to talk about is Gary Peters. So he's the junior senator from Michigan, for those who are not aware of who he is. Back in 2014, when Senator Carl Levin decided that he was going to retire after a very, very long time holding that seat, the idea was that this was going to be an extremely contested race. And Terry Lynn Land was the Republican candidate in this, running against Gary Peters. And what we saw actually happen all along the way was that things were not as you thought they would be. And one of the standout issues in the race turned out to be climate change. And Gary Peters, as a sitting U.S. congressman, was able to talk in great detail about how the lake, the Great Lake that Michigan borders, was such a core part of the economy, how if you have evaporating waters, it create lower water levels, that actually impacts the fishing industry. When there's water pollution, it can create algae blooms that really also impact water quality. And so he was able to talk about this, and he had a microphone because he was a sitting member of Congress. And he made, in particular, the issue of who Terry Lynn Land's contributors were a core part of the campaign as well. So the Koch brothers were among her contributors, and what he said and made part of his message was that they were people who were opposed to climate change, so no surprise that Terry Lynn Land doesn't believe in it. So if you look at this in the frame of a message box, you get to see how you start to parse out some of those things. So he made it very, very clear that the Great Lakes, water quality, the environment were all very core to the economy. So if you were impacting the environment in a bad way, you were impacting the economy in a bad way. And that is, again, something that would resonate with voters very, very much. And at the same time, he talked about the kind of pollution that occurs when you're creating petroleum as a fuel. Petroleum coke or pet coke became something that he would hold events around. You know, you would have these big rallies and press conferences where he would talk specifically about pet coke, which sounds like a really crazy idea, but isn't when you talk about it as it relates to the economy.
I think one of the things too that that the you on you is important to remember is that you're setting up the stakes of the election. What is this election all about? Why is there a difference between what I believe and what my opponent may believe? And so I think that is the essence of how you want the voters to frame the election. So when you say that, you know, Michigan's economy is dependent upon its lakes and access to a healthy lake, you're setting that up as the stakes of the election. You're choosing me against my opponent for this reason. And I think once you've invested in those stakes, you got to stick with it. I mean, one of the things that Linda mentioned early in the slides was repetition. So that's got to be, if you say this is what this election is all about, the constant theme throughout. Now, there are a lot of issues, as you can see by this, that you can tie into it. And one of the new phenomena are big outside groups that have influence in your campaign. And especially congressional races, they're very susceptible to large money organizations coming in and changing the message. In this case, Peters was able to use that as a reinforcement for the message he was having. The Kochs are an organization that is actually well known and positioned as climate deniers. So why not play to the narrative that you're given by them coming in with a lot of money and a lot of capability and use that as sort of political jujitsu, that the weight of their dollars, the weight of their impact is actually used against them? Because as we all know, the stakes of the election are clean water, a healthy lake, and the economy that surrounds that.
And of course, Terry Lynn Land also made use of that same philosophy and kind of switched the script on Gary Peters. And her version of it was, he's also funded by organizations that are swaying the way he thinks about things. He's this terrible radical who's funded by these crazy activists and labor unions, and they're really who's driving his agenda. And so that was her message. And in particular, you know, she also tied it back to the economy, but her version of it was that his policy proposals, the things that he was saying, are actually going to hurt our economy, in particular because what he wanted to end up with, in her view, was going to be an over-regulated system that was going to inhibit business growth, was going to inhibit economic growth. And so again, you know, you see these guys, they were very, very clear that if they were going to talk about the environment, and he may have made that the issue, but she then had to respond on it, then you better, you know, darn well tie it back to the economy. Otherwise, it's not going to be that relevant to people.
Now we're going to hear from Paul Tencher, the campaign manager for Gary Peters, and a little bit about how they use the environment in their campaign to create a winning formula.
I got to the campaign in March of the on year. Every single candidate that year could have used something to show people that the people that are funding these candidates, this is what they're doing to our land, this is what they're doing to our jobs. I think we had a very unique opportunity, especially in 2014, where the Koch brothers were playing such a large role in funding most of the Republican opponents across the country. We knew that we had to turn off the spigot of money. And so our opponent was important, but what was more important was making people realize who these people are and why they were supporting her at the time with millions and millions and millions of dollars. And so, you know, the reason that they wanted her in the Senate, not Gary Peters, was that she would loosen regulations to allow pollutants into the Great Lakes, and that's why they are buying and paying for her. And so our most important thing was not just to make sure that that the environmental ethos was part of our campaign. It was even more important that people knew how bad they were for the environment and what they would do to the Great Lakes. And you know, if it's not the Koch brothers, if it's a small school board race, and you know, in Ohio, there are people that are donating to these races now that have done awful things for communities, and people should make it a case to show where the money and where their supporters are backing them and what they're doing to their communities. anytime you can engage a movement instead of creating your own movement on a campaign is really important. There was a group of moms who are usually the most passionate and the most active in securing their children's health, and they were already organized. They were Black, white, brown, all shades and colors. They were old and young, and they were very concerned about the public health of their kids in this community. They literally wiped soot off of the children's playgrounds. And so they were fighting already. We were able to activate and engage them in a way that became very powerful in media narratives. I mean, getting back to basics is really important. So understanding a message box, understanding what your attacks are on other people, what the attacks will be on you, it's fundamental to campaigns. So it's not only important to have your research ready so that you can ensure your opposition research will hurt them the most, but it's really important to know what your problems are and so that you can respond to them. I think, you know, and we had this on Gary's campaign, I've had it on other campaigns, but once you know your self-research, that ability to respond in a way that makes the press feel like, oh, they've got this under control, is even more important than what you say. You know, it's not just in a U.S. Senate race or a presidential race, it's a school board race, right? Having the Little League coach ready to say, no, he or she would never waste taxpayer dollars, that I know them, is extremely, extremely important. When I started, there was no Twitter or Facebook, we were still faxing press releases. Your tweet is more important than the press release you put out. That first tweet you put out is going to be the most important thing you do, because that's what reporters are going to, or supporters are going to look at. So it's not just important for the press, but your team and your grassroots supporters need to see that you've responded decisively. And for the most part, you know, the media will see it on Twitter, and a lot of your supporters, especially women, will see it on Facebook. I think the paid part of social media is really important. It's where everything's going, especially in local races, and at the Senate level and the presidential level as well. And the organic stuff is great, but it's not organic. You have to organize on Facebook and Twitter just like you would organize in precincts. And so making sure that you have great influencers that are retweeting and doing your work on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram too is extremely important. I think we didn't focus on nationalizing it. We did everything we could to localize it. That was why our strategy works. That anytime we localize, it's usually better for us. And that's where people should be focused on, I think, is localizing these issues. Obviously, people are going to want a knee-jerk to go to Trump, but at state, local races, I think, for the most part, you'll see folks really worried about, you know, their local baseball field or things like that. So go to as many church picnics as you can go to. Go to places people wouldn't expect you to be. Remember, retail politics is still king in a lot of these races. And if the opportunity comes in to paint your opponent in a way that your district doesn't like Trump, then seize it. But don't make your whole campaign about Trump. It's probably not going to work. You got to make sure that people know who you are and they want to have a beer or a cup of coffee with you.
Another person that you might recognize from national television these days is Carlos Curbelo. He's a representative from Florida who has been on the air a lot talking about the devastation from Hurricane Irma and giving a firsthand account of what things look like on the ground, what the challenges are, how much it's going to cost in order to bring back the Florida economy from the impact of this hurricane. He's notable in particular because he's in a district in Florida that is actually overwhelmingly Democratic. This is a district that went for Hillary Clinton by 17 points when he first ran for office against Joe Garcia, the then Democratic congressman that represented the district in 2014. He won by a scant 3 points. But in 2016, he won by 12 points. And part of the reason is he has really defined himself. He is a standout among Republicans for talking about climate change directly, for taking it on as a core issue that impacts the Florida economy. So, you know, one of his famous lines is something along the lines of, we have to care about sea level because we're at sea level. And so, you know, he's made this something that he talks about really, really frequently, which has clearly appealed to people on both sides of the aisle and also the independents in the middle. So when you look at his message box, you know, this is another way of talking about the environment and the economy once again. So he's talking specifically about climate change. Again, it made him a standout. It made people at the national level really pay attention to the campaign in 2014 against Joe Garcia. And surprise, surprise, there's some Koch funding, finger pointing, that surfaced in this campaign as well. For it was Joe Garcia who was saying that Curbelo himself was funded by the Kochs. And again, the climate deniers, you know, it's the point he was trying to make was, can you really believe this guy? He says that climate change matters, but he's funded by climate deniers. And then on the flip side, I don't know if you wanted to go through it, Rick.
Yeah, I mean, again, stakes of this election, both candidates basically agreed that this is what the stakes of the election are. It doesn't necessarily have to be a differentiator, but this is the field of play that you wanted to have. I think what the Republican opponent was able to do here is have great situational awareness. You know, you live in a place that's at sea level. Your backyard is the Everglades. Of course, people in my district are going to believe that climate is real and that is something that affects us. And things like the storms and make them very vulnerable as individuals. And so the values base of this is that we need to protect ourselves by having good policies that allow our community to be able to prosper. Because in some cases, and Irma is another good example, when that hurricane came through, devastating that district, and not just because it was a powerful storm, but because of the low-lying areas that this district lies in makes them particularly vulnerable to the effects of a big storm like that. So the question isn't whether or not everybody in that district is sensitive to it or that either candidate is aware of that. What the difference is who's most likely to get something done on it. And in this case, being a Republican in a Democratic district actually is an interesting juxtaposition, because the Republican can say, look, I'm not doing this just because I want to win your votes. I'm, you know, my own Republican base is probably scratching their head wondering what in the world is he up to. But I'm doing it because I truly believe in it and I walk the walk. I don't just talk the talk.
Yeah, and Joe Garcia, rather ineffectively, frankly, tried to frame this as a trust issue. As you see, you know, most of the arguments that he made against Carlos Curbelo were about whether or not you could believe him based on who was funding him, or whether these were just talking points from a, quote, Republican, as opposed to somebody who would actually get things done, as Rick mentioned. And so we saw that play out in Florida. The last example is Martin O'Malley. So you might remember him from 2016 as one of the Democratic candidates. We talked an awful lot about Martin O'Malley during the cycle. Where he first made the environment core to who he was as a candidate and as a politician was actually when he was mayor of Baltimore. And then thereafter, when he was running against Bob Ehrlich to become governor of the state of Maryland. You know, he made a central part of his platform preservation of the Chesapeake Bay. He talked a lot about things like fishing and overcrabbing in the bay, the impact of oysters, and whether or not there ought to be farming in order to help filter the water. And so he just made that a really big part of who he was as an individual, and again, tied it back to the economy. So that the Chesapeake Bay is part of the economy in Maryland in a way that you just can't kind of differentiate the two. And then also something interesting about this race, I would say, when you look at the box, is that both Bob Ehrlich and Martin O'Malley, recognizing where Maryland kind of sits in the political landscape, it has traditionally been very Democratic, but is increasingly purple, as we've seen the governorship kind of flip-flop back and forth between Republicans and Democrats. Both Bob Ehrlich and Martin O'Malley actually would talk about how the Bay was important. Martin O'Malley just made it a centerpiece. They would both talk about how preserving the environment was an important piece of making sure that you have a strong local economy. They just had different emphasis. So, you know, Martin O'Malley would say a dead Chesapeake Bay is bad for business, and he'd be pretty dramatic about it, versus Bob Ehrlich, who would say, well, listen, if you really think about the way that the things work in our state, you've got this Democratic legislature, you need to have somebody who is a check and balance on them. It's why you need to continue with my leadership. And he would talk about the Chesapeake Bay, but he would say, we need to be clean and green, but we also need to make sure we're not over-regulating. So you're hearing some echoes from other campaigns that we've talked about here.
Yeah, and I think this is a great example of a juxtaposition between someone like O'Malley, who was talking about the values that people have about the Chesapeake Bay and their neighborhood and their way of lives and their future, versus Ehrlich, who was talking about issues. You know, how do you regulate it? How do you be counter to the Democratic legislature? I mean, these are things, as we talked earlier in this section, about that you trade off too easily, right? So he's down in the values pyramid in the issues section, talking about how those things would be regulated and how, or not regulated, and how those things, you know, would be done with legislative mandates. But what O'Malley was talking about was what this huge body of water that's had a profound impact on the lives of virtually everybody in the state has had. And when people start thinking about the jobs, when you talk about, you know, a dead Chesapeake Bay, they think about generations of oystermen, generations of crabbers, generations of tourism, you know, generations of fisheries that would be affected by a dead Chesapeake Bay. Intensity, values, that's what sells in a campaign. If you're running against someone who's talking about the issues and not the values, you're likely to win every time.
And now we're going to hear straight from the horse's mouth. We're going to hear from Martin O'Malley about how the environment played out during his gubernatorial campaign and what the dynamics were and how he talked about things.
Well, the recommendations I'd give to a first-time candidate running is to speak from your heart, speak with passion about the things that you care about. And certainly in this day and age, more and more of us care passionately about the health of this earth, the health of our land, our water, our air. It is the one story without reference. There's been a false choice put forward, a dichotomy, an either-or choice, that either we're going to have a healthier environment or we're going to have a healthier economy. The truth is, you cannot have a healthier economy for long unless you're also creating a healthier environment. I mean, there's really far more jobs to be created by addressing climate change than there is in pretending that it doesn't exist. The great anxiety in the politics of here and now is people's concern for their own jobs, their own livelihoods, and by extension, that of their neighbors in their home place. So when we talk about connected communications and making the case for a cleaner environment, we have to be mindful to always tie it back to local jobs in the places close to home. Whether it's a restaurant like this that serves the seafood of the Chesapeake Bay, you know, the crabs, the oysters, or whether we talk about, in Maryland now, the 3,000 people that are employed in the solar industry that didn't exist 10 years ago. You have to constantly bring it back to jobs, job creation, real people doing real things that actually give our kids a better shot at a more abundant and prosperous life. As governor, I would frequently say that while there's a cost to improving the health of the bay, there's an even greater cost to letting it die. In other words, if you think cleaning up the bay is expensive, you should see just what a terrible cost all of us would pay for generations if we let the bay die. In other words, a dead bay is bad for business, bad for job creation, bad for the health, prosperity, and opportunities we want to give to our children. During my years as governor, we preserved more open space in the state of Maryland, you know, our farmlands, woodlands, wetlands, than any other governor in history. And we did it in the middle of a recession when there were a lot of voices in the legislature that said, hey, we need that money for this or that shortfall or that budget gap. And I said, hold on, wait a minute. This isn't our money. This is money that really belongs to our kids, because it's only by preserving these open spaces we can give them a future that's more prosperous, that's healthier, where they're able to actually play and swim in the streams and enjoy the health of this place we call Maryland. Look, all of these political fights are tough, but that's why we elect leaders, right? And that's why good people run for office. It's not the easy fights that actually save lives or deliver better results. It's the tough ones. We knew the zip codes where their substandard rental properties led to children being poisoned with dangerous and debilitating levels of lead. But year after year, we shrugged our shoulders as if there wasn't anything we could do about it. So we came to the conclusion that the reason that lead poisoning happens year in and year out is because we don't do anything about it. I vowed that if I ever had the power, I was actually going to do something about it. So we started taking actions, universal testing of toddlers, following up when they presented with a higher level of lead, abating the properties, doing the remediation, actually having an inspections regimen that was intelligent and relentless and protecting kids. And we were able to cut by 90% the number of children in our city that were poisoned with the highest levels of lead in their bloodstream. And we carried that cause forward and did it as a state. For candidates who are told by their pollsters that they have to try not to offend anyone and to dumb down and turn their message into a gray pablum, I say that you need to put that advice to the side and realize that when people vote, they actually want to get things done. They want to vote for people who actually believe what they say and say what they believe and are willing to fight the tough fights in that arena of compromise to get things done, or at least to achieve a few steps of progress to getting it done. To candidates that are running for the first time and concerned about that inevitable moment that comes when you're attacked or an opponent strikes at you in fair or unfair ways, is you have to be clear about your own purpose. You know, if you're clear about why you're doing what you're doing, and you keep the focus on the best interests of the people that you're seeking to serve, then you're able to absorb those blows and realize that this is the price you're willing to pay on their behalf. The second you make a race about yourself and lose the focus on the people you're trying to serve is the second you start, you know, you start sinking. You have to keep it all about the people you're serving. Whether you're a first-time candidate or a candidate who's lucky enough to be running for re-election, it's very important that people understand where you stand. They might not even agree with you on every tactic or strategy to achieve that end, but if they know where you're headed, what your true north is, they can support that, and they can suspend their disbelief and actually come along with you and be a part of making things better.
And now we're going to open up to questions, if there's anybody in the room who has something they'd like to talk about.
So I'm wondering, in terms of the economy and the environment, what data resonates most with voters, and what wider messages when you speak about values resonate with voters?
Well, I think one of the ways you test it, right, in a survey is not only on a priority basis, right? So how do you judge the economic values in this issue in a listing, like from 1 to 5 or 1 to 10? But what I like a lot is, what are the competing values? So create a paragraph around what you think your message is, especially as it's delivering an economic benefit to the district. And then what is the opposing message, like we laid out in the message block, and test both against each other. What you are able to do then is see which voters migrate to those messages. What you don't want to see is your voters migrating to the opponent's message. But that's the only way to really know that, if you create the competing messages. And you have to be fair. Many times, I'll literally take the messages off of the candidate's website so that I know this is what they're pushing in order to create the comparison in those two fields.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's really about painting a picture and comparing your side versus their side. And also, if you're talking about a specific environmental issue, making it really concrete what it is you're talking about. So some of the data you might want to present are on the negative side. So if you talk about hurricanes, hurricane damage after Katrina and Rita was estimated to be something along the lines of $14 billion a year. So being very concrete, this is what happens to your economy when a terrible hurricane happens due to climate change. But on the flip side, you can also talk about what the positive picture is. So how many jobs are created when you actually get back in there and start focusing on infrastructure and all these other sorts of things. So that's pretty much it. That is how it's done. And if you are looking to do this on your own campaign, whether you're the candidate or you are the campaign manager or one of the senior level staff, one of the things you can do is look to the resources section for this module, and you will find your very own message triangle and your very own message box. And it is something we would really encourage you to do, is to go through the exercises and figure out what works for you so that you end up with the right kind of message that ties in the environment, makes it local, makes it about the economy or health or whatever it is that makes sense for you in your context. Just to summarize the day here, message making is not rocket science at the end of the day. You start off by trying to figure out who it is you want to talk to. You then think about what it is that actually matters to them, what's going to move them, and then you try some stuff out and you try to adjust as different dynamics come into play and make it work.
Thank you very much for being with us today to talk about how we form a message around climate and environment and make it practical for your candidates and your districts and your campaigns. So we hope you're going to find these tools that we've given you useful, and look forward to seeing those campaigns in full bloom.
And if you remember nothing else, remember that regardless of what side of the aisle you are on, the environment can be a very winning issue as long as you follow some of these tips.